This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, spam. It's not just for your email inbox anymore. A UW Green Bay music professor decided to repurpose some of her junk email and put it to music. We'll hear a few samples of how it turned out. Now, world leaders are joining together at the COP27 Climate Change Conference in Egypt to talk about greenhouse gas concentrations and damage being done around the world. COP27 is short for the 27th year of the Conference of the Parties, or the 197 nations that agreed to a United Nations Framework Convention back in 1992. The United States is at the conference again this year. In a speech, President Biden talked about climate issues, including U.S.-China relations, alternative energy funding, drought, and wildfires. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see happen when it comes to global cooperation, if any, on climate change issues? What do you want to see the U.S., the Biden administration, commit to? Do you have questions about the significance of this conference? What is going on? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Gregory Nemeth is a professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs. He specializes in energy systems analysis, policy analysis, and international environmental policy. Greg, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. Good to be here.
I want to first talk about the significance of this event. A lot of world leaders showing up, at least to make a speech here and there. A lot of countries involved. How important a forum is this when it comes to international cooperation on climate change?
Well, it's become the forum, as you said, since 1992, when 195 or so countries agreed to limit dangerous climate warming. We've had these annual conferences, and sometimes they're consequential, like 1997, the Kyoto Protocol, and 2015 with the Paris Agreement. And in the in-between years, there's kind of implementation, working out details, and starting new issues. And that's what we're seeing this time at COP27 in Egypt.
And setting the stage here, you mentioned past commitments made by countries around the world, especially leading industrial countries. How are we doing on those? How is the world doing when it comes to meeting emission standards that would slow the growth of climate change?
Yeah, well, the way I put it is the climate problem is getting worse, but the solutions are getting better. The problem is getting worse and that our emissions continue to grow and the temperatures continue to rise and we're seeing impacts everywhere. But on the other hand, the solutions that we have available, clean energy, ways of reducing emissions, ways of reducing energy, are becoming more affordable and performing better and becoming more efficient. So we've got good news and bad news on that. In terms of emissions themselves, which is kind of the focus of the COP. So the Paris Agreement in 2015, we had this agreement that the world would make efforts to keep warming well below 2 degrees and make efforts to keep it to below 1.5 degrees. And we're now at 1.2 degrees. And this is degrees Celsius, so about double that for Fahrenheit, above the pre-industrial average. So from 200 years ago, when we weren't burning fossil fuels. So we're already pretty far along. And so there really isn't a lot of space to stay under 1.5 and even not much to stay under 2 degrees. So there really is urgency to go from really slowing down the rise in emissions, which is what we've been doing, to starting to reduce them, you know, immediately, like in the next couple of years to start having declines in emissions. And, you know, there's a lot of ways that we could see that actually happening, but it's imperative that we do.
And before we get to some of those strategies, this has come up over the course of the climate change conversation over the years. People might hear 1.5 degrees, 2 degrees, and think, well, that's not that much warmer. But on a global scale, how much impact could, say, a 2-degree Celsius temperature increase have?
Yeah, it sounds tiny because you go out into a hallway from a warm meeting room and it's 10 degrees cooler Fahrenheit. So yeah, it's tiny, but globally average, it makes a difference. I guess to put two ways I'd put it in perspective, we're talking about warming by 2 degrees. If we do cooling by, say, 4 or 5 degrees, which is what we had 20,000 years ago, there was a mile of ice on top of Madison. So just a few degrees makes a really big difference. And we're going in the other direction in terms of warming. The other thing people wonder is, well, you know, does 1.5 degrees really matter versus 2 degrees? And, you know, it does matter on an array of indicators, but probably the best way to put it is there are about 1 billion people whose lives will be significantly adversely affected at 1.5 degrees that at 2 degrees would be okay. Then there's other people that are going to be affected even at 2 degrees. So it really does make a difference. As people say, every degree matters, even though it's kind of unfortunate that we're using the same units that we have in our everyday life when the range is much bigger. But for the whole planet, it makes a big difference.
As I mentioned, President Biden stopped at the conference. Here's a listen to his speech talking about the U.S. commitment to reducing emissions.
Today, finally, thanks to the actions we've taken, I can stand here as President of the United States of America and say with confidence, the United States of America will meet our emissions targets by 2030.
By 2030, that ended. Is that going to happen? What would it take to get there, Gregory?
What it would take would be, you know, we have a lot of progress on technology and renewables are getting cheaper. Electric vehicles are becoming really high performing. But what we were missing was some kind of federal policy that would kind of set expectations that we are actually going to reduce emissions and then provide avenues for people to adopt these clean technologies that haven't already done that. And almost by a miracle, we did that in August. We have the first time the federal government, that Congress has passed a substantial climate policy, and that's the Inflation Reduction Act. So, you know, when Biden goes to COP, it's completely different. When he says those things now, it comes with credibility because those tax credits in the Inflation Reduction Act, one, it's the tax code, so it's really hard to change. This is not like executive orders that Obama signed and then Trump reversed. And two, this is legislation that is in place for the next 10 years. And so it really is aligning expectations that renewables will probably be about twice as much as we would have had without that, and that our emissions are probably going to reduce about 42% by 2030 instead of 27%. So it really does bend the curve. Biden says that with credibility, whereas if we had not passed the Inflation Reduction Act, which is what it looked like in mid-August, that we would not pass it, he would not be able to make that kind of proclamation. So things are moving in the right direction in a lot of areas, and U.S. federal policy for the first time is one of those things that's moving in the right direction.
Talking to Gregory Nemeth from UW-Madison's La Follette School, looking at the big climate change conference, almost 200 countries involved right now in Egypt. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions about efforts to rein in climate change, the U.S. role in it, what you'd like to see from the U.S., from countries around the world. 800-642-1234 for your comments or questions. That's 800-642-1234. Greg, you mentioned emissions are one big theme. Another theme in this conference is who is causing climate change and who is suffering the consequences, often not the same countries. What's going on when it comes to the damage of climate change and who's liable for it?
Yeah, that's an important issue, and it's been raised to a really high profile issue this time at the COP. The basic issue is that when you put greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, they stay there a long time, like 100 years. It's really different from things like air pollution and particulates that rain out in matters of weeks. And so that means that all the development and emissions that have happened over the last 100 years, say, are still in the atmosphere now and stay in the atmosphere and continue to cause damages. And those damages are not connected at all to where the emissions came from. It's just a global soup of CO2 that's up there. And it turns out that if you live in a country that's primarily source of GDP is agriculture, and you're in a country where incomes are low, and you're in a country that, for whatever reason, is sensitive to things like weather events like monsoon or drought or low precipitation, those make you very vulnerable. And so at this COP, there's for the first time on the agenda this term called loss and damage, that there should be some compensation from those who have created the problem, developed countries, to those who are suffering the biggest effects, which are countries in the global south that have lower incomes and are more sensitive to what's happening with the climate. And so we'll see what comes out of that. That's probably one of the biggest open issues in the next 3 days for the rest of the conference, to see what can be agreed on in terms of commitments of financial flows from the global north to the global south.
I understand there's some reluctance from countries, including the U.S., to participate in something like that, or at least in how it's framed, because of the question of are we admitting liability in a legal sense if we pay this kind of compensation from a developed country to a country suffering the impacts of climate change? Is that an admission that under international law could say they can sue us under international law?
Yeah, I guess that's the concern. I mean, because for a lot of reasons, for any kind of, I don't know, just a pretty intuitive moral reason, we've created all this damage that's real and people are suffering from it, and that's real. And that finding a ways to, you know, alleviate their suffering with some financial flows that, you know, these are small amounts that we're talking about. Large amounts for these countries, but in terms of, you know, GDP of rich countries, these are tiny amounts. But yeah, I guess that is one of the negotiating positions to say, well, if we admit that there is damage that we've caused, that we open ourselves to, you know, I don't know, some kind of bigger movement on that. But, you know, I think there's just some inevitability to this now because we've taken so long to do something about it. So it's really been 34 years when we had the first congressional hearings on climate change in 1988. And here we are today, just starting to say that we might get emissions to fall in the next couple of years. And so we've burnt out a lot of time, like literally burnt a lot of fossil fuels, but we've used up a lot of time. And that's, you know, why we now have damages that we're going to have to pay for. We're going to have to pay for it in our own country and in our own state, some of it. And then, so, you know, I think it suits that we would end up paying for some of the damage we've caused to other states as well.
Talking to Gregory Nemet, professor at the UW-Madison La Follette School of Public Affairs, looking at this year's UN Climate Change Conference going on right now in Egypt. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What climate issues matter the most to you? Is climate on your mind? Was it during the election? What do you want to see from the U.S. when it comes to leadership on the issue, from other countries around the world? What questions do you have about what's at stake here? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Gregory Nemet, professor at the UW-Madison La Follette School of Public Affairs, with us today to talk about the UN Climate Change Conference happening now in Egypt. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you worried about the implications of climate change? What do you want to see from the federal government, from corporations, from the global community when it comes to climate change? What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. David joins us now in Jackson County. David, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I've been an environmental engineer my whole career mostly in air quality, and I've worked on a lot of the problems we've had in the state, acid rain, tires, leaking tanks. I want to know if there's something we can push for in our state to help improve our biodiversity and thus create more more oxygen, less CO2, because I do see a few areas that we could look at. I just don't know the numbers, and I haven't seen any cost-benefit impacts.
Gotcha. David, thanks for the call. Greg, things we could do here in Wisconsin. David mentioned biodiversity, that or other options that the state could take to contribute.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty clear to me that it's really just about transitioning away from fossil fuels to some other form of energy that's cheap, that's clean, and that's reliable. That's, I think, what everybody wants. And we now have tools that are available because of tremendous innovation that's happened. We've had solar's come down in cost by 90%. Batteries for electric vehicles have come down in cost by 90%. So, you know, the battery pack in a Nissan Leaf that 10 years ago was $40,000 just for the batteries is now $4,000. And so electric vehicles are now getting priced just like internal combustion engine cars. And so we've got these tools now that are affordable, and we've got congressional leadership with the Inflation Reduction Act that's giving Wisconsin and other consumers tax credits for purchasing electric vehicles, for installing solar panels and installing heat pumps, and moving away from fossil fuels in their homes and in transportation. And, you know, I think it's up to us as a state then to make the most of that. And some of that resides in what the governor's office can do in the state legislature. A lot of it, I think, goes in the Public Service Commission and how they make determinations about expanding electric vehicle charging infrastructure and switching to renewables. But these tools are available, and they actually work, and they're proven, and it's up to us to take full advantage of that and not go too slow on it. I think that's my biggest concern. I think the electric electrification of transportation, people that drive electric vehicles realize it's a transformative experience. It's more fun. There's, you know, things you can do. It's different. But we need to make these changes pretty quickly. If we end up being too cautious and too slow on it, we're likely to, suffer some of the environmental damages that that David raised in his concern about the call. So I think what we can do is take advantage of what Congress now has given us and implement those well in our state.
Thanks for the call, David, at 800-642-1234. Another issue, I think, at the conference, Greg, is with countries with less developed economies that want to develop them. They look at England and then the U.S. and then Europe and now China and India. They did a lot of that with coal, and then they did a lot of that with oil. Is there, what kind of options are there to help countries in that situation skip the fossil fuel phase and do something else that's not going to have that climate change impact?
Yeah, you know, I think that's exactly what we're kind of wanting them to do. And, you know, that's a lot of what with the clean development mechanism and other efforts that have been implemented over the last 20 years of these agreements have tried to do. I think it was just never completely convincing because it always seemed kind of expensive, or if developed countries were funding these, they were kind of funding them there so they didn't have to change their own economies. That's kind of the experience of the 90s and the early 2000s. But now when you look at renewables potentially being deployed in rapidly growing economies, China's very far along, but India now is making important decisions about whether they develop with coal or solar, and they kind of go back and forth from year to year on which one they prioritize. They're really on the fence about it. And then other big economies that are growing that are going to have large shares of population like Indonesia, Nigeria, and Vietnam really have the chance to skip the fossil fuel economy. And, you know, now we're at a stage where it's less expensive in kind of a full life cycle, building a grid with based on renewables and electrified transportation than it would be with fossil fuels. And I think that was a promise that I think a lot of developing countries kind of didn't really believe, because they said, well, as you suggest in your question, you know, all these rich countries developed with fossil fuels, why should we have to do it in a different way? But now it's gotten to the point where this different way is actually better, because it not only helps the global climate, but it helps local air pollution. And think about cities and some of these developing economies and the air pollution there. So there really are these health co-benefits in the near term and local that I think will drive a lot of the adoption. And it's really not about sacrifice and about paying more at this point. It's about just doing things differently. And that's the hurdle we need to make.
Let's go back to our callers. Virginia is with us now in Rock County. Virginia, hi.
Hi. You know, there's a major emphasis on fossil fuels to the exclusion of everything else. And one of the worst causes of climate change is animal production. An estimated 85% of all U.S. agriculture land is used in the production of animal fuels. And we have deforestation, we have habitat destruction. All over the world, animal production is a problem. And at this conference, they had a chance to make an issue of that. And instead, have you looked at the menu? They're flying salmon in from halfway across the world.
Virginia, I gotcha. Greg, animal agriculture, how big a factor is that in climate change?
Yeah, it's a good point to raise. It's a big factor. You know, getting protein from animals is super inefficient because you're basically using all this energy and land and feed to, you know, grow an animal that you use just a small part of. So yeah, if we wanted to really reduce emissions completely, we need to reduce emissions in agriculture, and there's ways to do that. But a lot of it has to do with what we were just talking about eating less meat and switching to different, less carbon intensive meat. So I think it's an important issue to raise. And it's one that I think a lot of people are uncomfortable raising, that we might have to make changes that are not just about the energy infrastructure, but about our daily life, how we get around, how we get to work, and even what we eat. That seems really intimate. And I think a lot of people are, you know, averse to other people telling them what to do about what they eat, and some governments are actually quite, hesitant to do that or prohibit that from their citizens. But boy, there's a lot of changes that like that, behavioral changes that could make a big difference. And, you know, if you just look at some of the lifestyles in really low energy intensive situations, they look pretty appealing. It's not about sacrifice. It's not people that are being poor, but it does involve changing some habits, changing behaviors, and in some cases, some investment. So I think, yeah, it's good to raise that too. It's about some of the behavioral changes as well.
Time for one more caller. Bruce is with us in Bayfield. Hi, Bruce.
Yeah, hi. I'm very happy to hear your speaker make mention of lifestyle, because while technology is certainly a part of the solution, looking at the fossil fuel industry, looking at agribusiness, those are all pieces of the puzzle. But perhaps most important is that we look at our consumption levels. We've got 8 billion people on the planet. We cannot continue to consume, especially those of us in affluent countries like the United States. We cannot be consuming 10 times what the average person in the world consumes.
Bruce, thanks for the call. Just a minute or so left. Greg, do you see a mindset change coming that Bruce is looking for there?
I do. Yeah, I see it on college campuses where I am. The amount of vegetarian options is really growing, and it's a peer thing. So students may have initiated it for whatever reason, and their roommates start doing it, and other people they eat with start doing it. So some of these lifestyles can spread. And again, you know, it's not all about sacrifice and doing without it. It's often just making a change that can be pretty appealing and have a lot of other benefits, often their health benefits, which are really important to a lot of people. So yeah, I think that's an really important part of this global issue that we're talking about, is some of the local and even personal changes that can make a difference.
Greg, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you. Great to be here.
I've been talking to Gregory Nemeth, professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs. He was with us to talk about the 2-week COP27 Climate Change Conference. It's going on now, last week of the conference right now in Egypt. U.S. participation there. If you have a climate question, something you've been wondering about, let us know, and we might tackle it in a future segment. Email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, many Rohingya refugees from Myanmar settled here in Wisconsin. Kate and her guests take a look at their lives here in the state. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. I don't usually follow the worlds of style, design, and fashion, but this story caught my eye, and if you've got a newborn coming along in your family, it might be important for you. The hot new color for families with newborns, we're talking furniture and clothes, decorations, even toys, the hot new color is beige. As reported in the Wall Street Journal, there's been a growing interest from parents for neutral colors, as shown in sales, online searches, and more. The big colors are beige, blonde, brown, and ecru. And look up ecru. The dictionary says it is the light beige color of unbleached linen. Mixing things up there. Why are those big colors now? Apparently they work great for social media pictures, and some parents hope that calm colors will equal calm kids. The article quotes a psychologist who's a bit worried, says kids need variety to stimulate their minds. A neuropsychologist says it probably won't harm the kids to live surrounded by those neutral colors, but quote, I don't think many kids' favorite color is beige. As a former kid myself, I agree. When boring hues make them snooze, kids lose. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we learned about a program in Milwaukee County that's helped secure housing for more than 1,600 people. First, I got some exciting news in my email yesterday. The Gulf Research Center in Saudi Arabia is happy to finance my projects. Finally, I can drop this radio gig and focus on Rob's robot dinosaurs. Wait, what's that? You got that email too? They can't be able to finance all our projects. I guess it must have been spam email. Now, for most people, we hopefully recognize that it's spam, delete it, and move on. Not our next guest. Michelle McQuaid-Dewhurst is a professor of music at UW Green Bay. She plays principal horn with the Widener Philharmonic and the Manitowoc Symphony, and she writes music inspired by, among other things, spam emails. Michelle, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, usually we view those spam emails as disposable. What inspired you to make some art out of them?
Well, there was a period where I suddenly noticed I was getting a lot more spam than usual. I don't really know why. And I noticed that the tone of some of these emails had changed, and some of them were strangely aggressive and some of them were weirdly charming. And I guess I started opening them because I was trying to figure out why there were so many extra. And at a certain point, I asked myself the question, what would happen if I decided, instead of trying to filter them out, but I let them in and tried to do something with them? And that's where these little songs came from.
Well, let's get a taste of your work. This is a piece called Have You Been Told? Tinnitus or tinnitus cures involved here. I think we're going to hear the whole thing. These are pretty short. Yeah, so I get the urgency there. You really captured the urgent tone in that email you were talking about.
Thank you very much. And I tried to match the pitch of my own experience with the issue here.
Right, yeah, a occupational hazard for a musician, tinnitus. Now, you go into these emails, you read them. How do you start, like, looking, taking that text, I guess that's the libretto for your piece, and building some music around it?
Well, I've obviously rejected a lot of spam because I have more source material than I could ever actually use. So I look for just odd turns of phrase or odd approaches to the subject. So, for example, I have one called Secret Admirer, and it is the most demure invitation to adult material that I've ever seen. It comes at it from this sort of shyness and, oh, I'm afraid to contact you, but if you just click this link. And so I'm looking for an attempt to try to trick me into clicking the link. By the way, I've never clicked the link.
Good. I was going to say.
Yeah. And then from there, it's just a matter of figuring out where it fits in a vocal part and building an environment for that text to sing and be made clear.
Now, I've seen the tinnitus ones, and I've seen the Secret Admirer spam. I want to set up the next excerpt we're going to play, Pura Bella. What is this is what I haven't encountered, I don't think. What is the email spam that's the basis for this one?
Sure. I think, you know, like so much advertising, these messages are preying on our fears and insecurities, and they're trying to make us click. And so this one is aimed at women, and it's about physical insecurities and trying to sell some beauty products.
That's why I don't get it. Okay, that makes sense. Well, here's an excerpt from a song called Pura Bella. I love the setup and the punchline there.
Thank you. I wanted to draw that one out a little bit before we got to the punchline.
Definitely. Now, these are short pieces, as I mentioned. You've got a bunch of them. I mean, is there an epic, opera in the works with these spam-influenced compositions?
You know, it's hard to tell a unified story, true, I think, through spam. It's more of a patchwork quilt of all our neuroses, I think.
But I mean, that is kind of the story, right? I mean, the spams are out there because presumably they're working on somebody. And I don't know, you're kind of capturing this weird spamscape, if I can make up that word.
Yeah, people must be clicking the links. Otherwise, we wouldn't keep getting these messages.
And now I think we've heard some of the audience reaction to these. What's it like for the live performances? People are seeing these and experiencing them in real time.
It's been really fun to see the reaction. I do hope people will laugh. These are not meant to be overly serious at all. I think there are some deeper messages about why these are the messages that we're getting and how these marketers are trying to work on us. But I'm content if people can just take them in and sort of recognize something that we all experience in our email boxes.
I'm always a little reluctant to ask artistic types about their next project, but I will ask, is there a spam you've gotten in the last few days that you're thinking, yeah, this could be the next piece?
Well, I do have one that I finished recently. I haven't found the next one yet, but the one I finished recently is about losing 36 pounds before Christmas.
Ouch.
So that one's timely.
Timely and a bad idea. Michelle, thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
Thank you for having me.
That's Michelle McQuaid-Dewhurst, professor of music at UW-Green Bay. She talked to us about her project to repurpose those spam emails that I think most of us get, if you have email, into songs for voice and cello. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about public art in southern Wisconsin.
In a particular neighborhood in Madison, there are birds that you don't need binoculars to see. They tower 3 feet tall and stand completely still. WPR's Jenny Peake introduces us to Madison-based artist Joe Jensen, who started crafting the giant wooden birds for her neighbors during the pandemic.
There's a street on Madison's east side that's dotted with larger-than-life birds. A sandhill crane, a red-winged blackbird, a pink flamingo. No two are alike, except for a couple of cardinals. Artist Joe Jensen is behind the eye-catching wooden replicas. She says what started as a gift for one neighbor exploded into a painted flock, transforming a stroll down the sidewalk into a birder's paradise. When I visited Jensen's home studio, she told me with a wry smile how the idea caught on.
Well, I've been making art my entire life, painting birds. This started last year. And it, like I said, it was just a fluke, something to do. I made a large robin because I was yearning for spring. So I put it out in my yard, and my neighbor Anita came by and told me that it was her, I believe, spirit animal. So, of course, I thought, well, if it means that much to you, and I gave it to her. And then another neighbor said, I would really like you to make me a red-winged blackbird. And then neighbor Julie across the street, I've made several for her. And from then on, it was just one after another.
Jensen shows me the spiral notebook where she keeps track of all the wooden birds she's crafted so far. She reads the names one by one.
Yeah, there's a yellow warbler in there, and a titmouse, and a kookaburra, hummingbirds, goldfinch, nuthatch, indigo bunting. I made my neighbor who has bees a queen bee. Whooping cranes, kingfishers, barn owls, doves, orioles, night herons.
While her artistry is apparent, Jensen breaks down how she creates the wooden birds and shares tips for people who want to make their own feathered friends.
They're made out of plywood, half-inch plywood, and I cut them out with a jigsaw. I purchased a projector so that I can trace them onto the wood. I was freehanding it, but they get a little distorted when you freehand. So I put them on the wood, cut them out with a jigsaw, sand them a bit, and then I prime them, and then I paint them with acrylic paint, and then I coat them with a waterproof polyurethane. Well, they're much larger than life. The robin was probably about 3.5-4 feet long, beak to end of the tail, so it's a big robin. And the egrets are, maybe close to 4 feet tall. I'm limited by what I can lift, so basically I get 2x4 foot pieces of plywood. I am not going into mass production on these things. I am only making them for neighbors because they take a long time to make, depending upon the complexity of the colors in it and what the bird's doing and so forth. I mean, it can take a couple of days to make these. So, sorry folks. You can figure it out. I just told you how to make them,
Looking at her own yard, Jensen says she hopes the carved creations can be a way for people to express themselves and have a little fun along the way.
I think in Wisconsin, people have seen the ubiquitous Dutch people bending over showing their bloomers and stuff. the bathtub Blessed Virgins and things like that. So however you want to junk up or beautify your yard is up to you.
WPR's Jenny Peek brought us that story on artist Joe Jensen's Wooden Birds in Madison. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, we take a look at a program in Milwaukee that provides housing for people experiencing homelessness, no strings attached. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Now we're checking in with a Milwaukee program that has helped more than 1,600 people get housing since it was founded in 2015. Milwaukee County Housing Division's Housing First program secures housing for homeless people, no strings attached. It's different from many conventional homelessness outreach programs, which might require individuals be sober before they're allowed housing. Housing First is based on a national model. It was founded in New York and has been replicated around the world. Eric Collins-Dyke is the Assistant Administrator of Supportive Housing and Homeless Services for the Milwaukee County Housing Division. Eric, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
I gave the very basics there, Eric. Can you talk more about how Housing First works in Milwaukee?
Yeah, I think, you know, back in 2015, we started to realize some of the more antiquated models of housing that required sobriety, different tiers of adherence to certain things to access housing. It just wasn't working for the individuals we were serving on the street. And so Housing First is essentially the name, and that housing comes first before anything. You know, we fundamentally believe that housing is a basic human right. And so what we started to do is we started to look at ways that we could get individuals off the street quickly into housing and into safe and supportive spaces. And what we realized is by offering housing first directly off the street and then wrapping the services around them once they were in housing, which was much more conducive, number one, to ending their homelessness, and number two, to keeping them off the street consistently, where they weren't going in somewhere and then ending up back on the street. So essentially what we do is we offer our scattered site voucher programs to individuals who are on the street, wraparound case management once they get in housing, and then work with them on their goals after they're in their apartment, as opposed to previously having to require all of those things before they were in an apartment. And as you can imagine, trying to survive on the street on a daily basis and also adhering to all of those requirements got really tough for the folks we were serving who were outdoors.
And now I think when I think of a public service, for better or worse, I think of a lot of you know, paperwork and bureaucracy before you can make something happen. Obviously, if you're homeless, you probably don't have access to a computer with internet or things like that. How do you help expedite that for people so they can get connected with this service?
Yeah, so our outreach team does housing-focused outreach. So every time we go on the street all over the county, as we engage with individuals, housing is first and foremost our point of engagement. You know, we work with them to build a rapport. Our outreach team is fantastic. And we really try to put together a housing plan from day one. And the goal is to get somebody into an apartment or indoors as quick as possible. And this philosophy has really transcended into across the board policy throughout the community, all the outreach teams, our local continuum of care, where we really look at now ways to triage people into housing. And what we found is significant cost savings in terms of access to emergency services. People are, using much more preventative ways of accessing healthcare once they're in housing. Our outreach team is now equipped with the tools to be able to house individuals quickly off the street, straight from the street, as opposed to steps 1, 2, 3, and 4. To access housing. It's now a straight shot indoors.
Can you talk more about the costs, the money going into this system to provide housing versus the benefits, including, as you mentioned, hopefully lower healthcare costs?
Yeah, so when we started this back in 2015, we looked at the first 85 participants in our program, and we looked at the emergency services that they accessed prior to going into housing. And then we looked at the 12 months after they were in housing. And so we looked at detox, psychiatric crisis services, inpatient services, and crisis mobile calls. And after they were in housing for 12 months, we saw a significant drop in those services to a little over $700,000 compared to when they were homeless. And really what that spoke to was just the essential, simple stability of housing and being having a stable, dignified place to live and wake up every day. And to build on that, it's a baseline to sort of build your life and get access to more consistent care, consistent services, and also our community-based case management that we wrap around individuals once they're in our program helps a lot with that. You know, that juxtaposition of access to care when they were on the street compared to when they were in housing really helped push the program forward and showed its efficacy to the community.
We're talking to Eric Collins-Dyke from the Milwaukee County Housing Division, looking at the housing first approach to homelessness in that county and how it's worked over the last 7 or so years. Eric, you've mentioned substance abuse and addiction, a common problem, not a universal problem, but a common problem for people experiencing homelessness. What have you learned about outcomes in dealing with addiction and substance abuse for people who are on the street versus people who have this housing?
Yeah, it's a great question. And, you know, I think, too, in terms of the way we look at the issue and all the complexities that are sort of wrapped around someone who's experiencing homelessness, it first and foremost is a housing problem. They're homeless because they don't have housing. And so I think the way we look at it from a harm reduction standpoint, if somebody is actively using and dealing with certain things to help them deal with the trauma they've had in their life, is it's much easier and much more therapeutic and much more holistic to address those things once somebody is in housing. Trying to survive on the street and the daily grind, you know, people are just trying to get through the day. And so I think once we get them into housing, no matter where they're at, whether they're actively using or they're sober, we put together a plan and collaboration with them that works for them. And it looks different for everybody. You know, I think what we've seen, you know, housing in its just in its essence, can lead to some mitigation and use, can lead to wanting to move forward potentially towards sobriety or getting active treatment. And we also support people where they're at, like once they're in there, and if that's not something they can do right away. But being able to do that once they're in housing compared to when they're on the street is such a healthier way and more dignified way to do things. And the folks that we serve on the street, they deserve that.
Now, since 2015, have you seen a lot of what you consider to be success stories from the people you've been working with to provide this housing?
So we've seen a lot of individuals that were homeless a long time, 5, 10, 15 years, get into our program and stay in our program. We have over a 96% retention rate, meaning since they've been in, they've stayed in, which we're really proud of. I also think it's allowed us to be more creative in our street outreach and the other teams in the community as well. They now have more tools in terms of having quicker access to housing resources that they can offer to folks directly off the street, as opposed to just some of the more traditional street outreach. You know, we now have this housing focused lens whenever we're on the street, whenever we're engaging with individuals. And I think it's sort of helped show that there can be a direct relationship between street outreach and permanent housing. You know, we can get folks directly into housing off the street. And I also think, you know, as we've shown efficacy of the program across the system, it's allowed other programs to attach themselves to this philosophy and build policies around it. So their programs are housing first as well.
Now we hear more and more about housing shortages, unaffordable housing, and also a limited numbers of federal housing vouchers. Do you have the tools you need to serve as many people as you would hope to?
I think we always need more resources. You know, one thing I'll say is we always will need more affordable housing. You know, as I said earlier, you know, homelessness on its face is a housing problem. Yes, there are many other complexities and layers to it, but more affordable housing is the number one thing that we continue to need to advocate for across the board. You know, every year we have new inflow into our system, more individuals experiencing housing insecurity. And so the consistent resource of affordable housing is needed. It's the number one thing that I think can get us to our goal and reduce homelessness, not only in our community, but across the state and across the country.
Yeah. In our last half a minute, Eric, if somebody's listening in another community wants to try this, one piece of advice to get them started.
So I would encourage you definitely to engage with local landlords and make sure that you develop those relationships as well. I also think educating the community on housing first and all the layers to it. Many times folks think it's just the housing component, and there's a large service delivery element to it as well. So it's not only getting individuals into housing quickly and using that housing as human right as your lens, but also providing significant case management services once they're in there to support them as they integrate back into the community.
Eric, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Eric Collins-Dyke, Assistant Administrator of Supportive Housing and Homeless Services for the Milwaukee County Housing Division. He talked to us about the county's Housing First program. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, civil dialogue has taken some hits in American politics in recent years, but a Wisconsin panel says it's savable and it's worth saving. Check out a new call for civic communication about politics. And a doctor makes the case that the U.S. has spent a lot on individual health, but not on public health. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.